in our opinion, a three-way race is just a recipe for ending up with Mr. Dunleavy as the governor.
Concern over a potential three-way race for governor as the deadline to drop out looms. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 31st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Northern Edge military exercises to go ahead amid disagreement about effects on the environment.
I think the problem is that they don't have, and we don't have, enough sound science to make a good decision.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Landing a job in Alaska's high-demand industries like welding, construction, medical billing, or marine transportation is now more affordable. The University of Alaska has reduced tuition for more than 300 career and technical education courses by 25%. From Ketchikan to Kotzebue, there has never been a better time to get started on your path to a new career. Learn more at www.alaska.edu/starthere. This message brought to you by the University of Alaska.
Governor Bill Walker and former U.S. Senator Mark Begich are competing for many of the same voters in this year's election for governor. Tuesday is the deadline for candidates to drop off of the ballot, and supporters of Walker and Begich and those who are fine with either candidate are concerned about a three-way race with former state senator Mike Dunleavy. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman spoke with vocal supporters of the two candidates, as well as Alaskans who feel caught in between them.
Pua Maunu is a Juneau resident who supports Governor Bill Walker, who's an independent. She says his decision to cut permanent fund dividends was particularly courageous.
I think it's easy to criticize Governor Walker, and that's why I admire that he was able to make that difficult decision because the state legislature was just not moving one way or another.
But Maunu voices mixed feelings as she talks through whether Mark Begich, a Democrat, should drop off the ballot before the deadline.
I mean, I don't think Mark Begich or Governor Walker should drop off on either end to try to consolidate one or the other because each represents a segment of people that are going to be voting for them. And I think it does weaken both the Democratic and Independent side, but I think that I'm not sure.
And Maunu is where a lot of centrist and left-of-center voters are. The math in a three-way race favors the Republican Dunleavy. It's nearly unprecedented for conservative and Republican candidates to share less of the vote than former Governor Sean Parnell had 4 years ago. That's when he lost to Walker in a close race with only two major candidates. Other than the first election for Alaska's governor, only once have conservative and Republican candidates combined to have less than the 46% that Parnell received. Power brokers who supported both Walker and Begich 4 years ago, when Begich was running for U.S. Senate, had been choosing sides. The Alaska AFL-CIO Labor Federation endorsed Walker. AFL-CIO President Vince Beltrami says Walker's stand on a complete fiscal plan, as well as his administrative orders favoring workers and the proposed natural gas pipeline, make him union's choice. Beltrami would like to see Begich withdraw.
In our opinion, a three-way race is just a recipe for ending up with Mr. Dunleavy as the governor.
Anchorage Democratic State Senator Berta Gardner also sees the math as a problem, but she says Begich is the stronger candidate. In part, that's because Walker's approval rating fell after the PFD was cut, once through a Walker veto and twice by the legislature.
In a head-to-head Walker-Dunleavy race, I don't think the governor can win. And I believe that Mark Begich has a much better chance of winning.
Gardner says that Walker would make things easier if he withdrew. Walker's campaign has consistently said he would not drop out. Begich also has so far resisted calls to withdraw. Anchorage Democratic State Representative Andy Josephson gave money to Walker's campaign before Begich joined the race. He says both are strong candidates.
I think they would both do a good job as governor. And I am profoundly and deeply concerned about their splitting votes. There are thousands of Alaskans that would vote for either gentleman, and that's a problem. And I'm hoping that in the next, oh, 3 or 4 days, one of them withdraws.
While Begich and Walker have taken similar positions on many policy issues, the campaign has put a spotlight on their differences. Planned Parenthood votes endorsed Begich. Alaska State Director Jessica Clare says Begich will stand strong on women's health care and reproductive rights. The organization supported Walker's decision to expand Medicaid eligibility, but it opposed other Walker administration decisions. They include the defense of limiting Medicaid funding for abortions and the decision against vetoing a law that limits sex education.
Yes, we are concerned about Mike Dunleavy becoming governor, but also concerned about another term of Bill Walker being governor.
The withdrawal deadline has been significant in the past. After winning the Democratic nomination, Malott merged his campaign with Walker's before the deadline in 2014. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers released its final scoping report today for the proposed Pebble Mines Environmental Impact Statement. The 90-day scoping period ended June 29th. It was an opportunity for the public to voice concerns and possible alternatives as part of the federal permitting process. The Army Corps received 175,000 submissions. Socioeconomic impacts and the environmental review process were topics most frequently addressed. The summary of scoping comments was dominated by apprehension that the proposed mine would pose an environmental and socioeconomic threat to the region. Among the specific concerns, commenters asked the Army Corps to consider possible impacts to subsistence uses, fisheries, and air and water quality. On the other hand, some commenters pointed to possible economic benefits, such as more local jobs. Organizations opposed to Pebble Mine, including Trout Unlimited and the United Tribes of Bristol Bay, have criticized the summary. They say it did not provide a thorough representation of scoping comments or enough details about how comments will be incorporated into the environmental impact statement. The public will have another chance to provide input after the Army Corps releases its draft environmental impact statement in January 2019. Ever since the state filed a petition in January of this year for a roadless exemption, opponents have argued that the move reopens a debate that was finally closed in 2016. As KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports, the roadless rule has been controversial for nearly 2 decades at the highest levels of government.
The Tongass Land Management Plan underwent an extensive overhaul in 2016 and pivoted toward a multiple-use strategy that would rely progressively less on the harvest of old-growth trees and more on second growth. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski was never a fan of the updated Tongass plan, and she is fully behind the new agreement between the state and the Forest Service to come up with a roadless rule exemption that is specific to Alaska. But roadless exemption is a hot-button term. In remarks to Sitka Media during the congressional recess this summer, Murkowski made it clear that she is aiming for something different.
It's not a roadless exemption. And that is something that the delegation had asked for and that the governor had asked for. I had a long sit down with the secretary, and he said, look, if I were governor, I too would ask for an exemption. But he said, I'm trying to be pragmatic here and just seeing how that would work going forward. And he said, you know, basically, we can either set ourselves up for litigation for a long time and hope we win on it, or we can try a more collaborative strategy.
Senator Murkowski favors the state-specific approach to roadless since, in her words, it won't be a bunch of people from Washington, D.C. parachuting in. A task force of Alaskan stakeholders will design the plan for both the Tongass and Chugach forests. But that's exactly what the conservation community believes happened during the 2016 overhaul of the Tongass Land Management Plan. It was a stakeholder-based process that looked at the forest as more than just a place to grow trees. Southeast Alaska Conservation Council attorney Buck Lindekugel thinks Senator Murkowski is out of touch with what's happening on the ground.
The timber industry makes up less than 1% of all the jobs and wages in Southeast Alaska. Why are we perpetuating controversy that isn't there in order for them to get more subsidized logging allowed? It just doesn't make sense.
Following the close of the public comment period on October 15th, the Forest Service will begin a complete environmental review as part of the public rulemaking process. it will be fraught with political and legal hazards. The roadless rule went into effect on January 12, 2001, just 8 days before President Bill Clinton left office. The state of Alaska immediately filed a complaint and won a temporary exemption from the rule in 2003. In 2011, a federal court set aside Alaska's temporary exemption, and the Tongass and the Chugach were under the roadless rule again. After yet one more brief reversal by a three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the full court voted in 2015, 6-5, denying Alaska's complaint, and the state has been under roadless ever since. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, uncovering the history of a famous revolver in Juneau.
Those letters purportedly say that U.S. Marshals had a firm discussion with Wyatt Earp when he arrived in town.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, investing in Alaska by hosting local interns and donating to University of Alaska programs like the UAA Summer Engineering Academy. More at bp.com/Alaska. And by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
A Fairbanks woman is charged with killing her two infant children. Fairbanks police report that 23-year-old Stephanie LaFontaine faces first and second-degree murder charges in the suffocation deaths of a 4-month-old in 2015 and a 13-month-old last year. Speaking at a press conference yesterday, Fairbanks Police Chief Eric Jukes says the child murders leave law enforcement at a loss for words.
How do we even imagine that? How do we, as a justice system, how do we make this right? And unfortunately, there's just nothing we can do to make this right, to make it better.
Police say the 13-month-old was brought to the hospital not breathing on November 20th, 2017. That resulted in police looking into the September 2015 death of LaFontaine's 4-month-old, who died of similar symptoms. Police say their investigation found that LaFontaine had done internet searches for ways to suffocate and other topics that indicated she was researching how to kill. Chief Jukes noted extensive police work that went into the case.
There's the work you see, and there's the work you don't see. And this is a prime example of the work that you don't see. Our detectives have been working this case. Avery Thompson has been working this case for 9 months, thousands of hours. And we've estimated that if we printed this report out, it would be over 100,000 pages. That's the amount of work that goes into a case like this that no one sees and that we don't talk about.
Jukes also credited the victim's family for their help with the investigation.
They trusted us. They stuck with us. And they allowed us to work this case and trusted that we would bring this to where it is now. And we were able to do it. They shouldered the grieving process alone, and we're going to bring this out to light and hopefully provide some kind of closure to them.
Stephanie LaFontaine was arrested yesterday and arraigned on murder charges today. After requests from Gulf of Alaska communities that the U.S. military reschedule or cancel its Northern Edge exercises in the Gulf, officials recently announced they'll go ahead and hold the training this spring. Northern Edge involves all five branches of the military and takes place every other year. Some tribes, communities, and conservation groups are worried the exercises, which can use live munitions and sonar, could harm marine life. Military officials say environmental studies show the exercises cause little to no harm. Dasha Eaton with KMXT has more.
Captain Bryant Davis, Director of Public Affairs for Alaska Command, says the biggest reason they plan to hold the exercises in May, like usual, is weather and the safety of participants.
The biggest driver for that is really the sea states in the Gulf of Alaska. As I mentioned, this is really an aerial exercise, but we do have aircraft that will be flying over the Gulf of Alaska. And if one of those pilots or an air crew member had to eject or bail out of their airplane, it really complicates the recovery operations if sea states are out of a specific range.
Davis says the majority of the exercises take place in interior Alaska. He adds that the military has done extensive environmental studies that indicate the training has little to no impact on fishing and marine mammals. Over the past few years, the number of Alaska communities, tribes, and groups opposed to the exercises has grown. Some want them rescheduled for fall, when they believe they would less affect sea life, including the Shunack tribe of Kodiak. Tom Lance, the tribe's natural resources director, says they're still concerned.
I think the problem is that they don't have, and we don't have, enough sound science to make a good decision. And today, being that we're at a tipping point with our environmental conditions in the ocean, and we should err on the side of caution and not do something that might unintentionally impact our marine resources.
In 2015, Shunack Tribe sent the military a list of demands for continuing the exercises in the Gulf. Lance says they only adopted one, excluding use of ordnance on important fishing grounds east of Kodiak Island. A number of other tribes have also opposed the exercises. Military officials say they're still in the planning stages and can only confirm that they're scheduled for May. In addition, officials say they're planning outreach to coastal communities about Northern Edge this fall and spring. In Kodiak, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Salvage efforts continue for the FV Pacific Knight. The 58-foot ship sank near Dillingham in late July. KTLG's Avery Lill has the latest.
The Pacific Knight has been sitting on the bottom of the Nooshkak Bay near Clark's Point for over a month now. The United States Coast Guard is still investigating what caused the Petersburg-based Saner and Longliner to capsize on July 25th. It was in Bristol Bay operating as a tender during the commercial salmon fishing season. The owner of the vessel is contracting with Resolve Marine on salvage efforts. In the week following the sinking, a dive team removed 1,400 gallons of fuel and 700 gallons of oily water from the vessel. It's still unclear how much fuel spilled. The company is now working on refloating the boat. Todd Duke is a manager with Resolve Marine.
The past few days, we've been passing chains underneath the vessel and connecting them to our crane barge. We turned it and we picked the vessel so it's sitting somewhat upright now. We've been using a tool we call an airlift to remove sand and silt from around the vessel so that we can get the chains underneath. And we'll continue doing some airlift and more chain connections in order to go ahead and lift this thing completely out of the water.
Once the ship is lifted, Resolve Marine will attempt to stabilize it so it will float on its own. Then the Pacific Knight will be towed to Dutch Harbor, where stakeholders, including the Coast Guard, can conduct further investigation on the vessel. Duke estimates it will take about a week to refloat, stabilize, and move the boat. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, the Wild Wild Northwest. A bar in Juneau claims it has a pistol that belonged to one of history's most notorious gunslingers. It's a tale shrouded in mystery, much like the man himself. Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick wondered whether the story checks out.
Hold it, stranger.
Wyatt Earp was among the most famous frontier lawmen. In 1881, he and his brother fought alongside Doc Holliday in a deadly confrontation with outlaws at the shootout at the OK Corral in Tombstone, Arizona. A decade after his death, the 1939 film Frontier Marshal was one of the earliest in a long line of films about his brutish style of justice.
He ain't dead, just sort of grazed him. You'll come to in a few minutes and you can lock him up. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'll go back and get some sleep.
Who are you?
My name's Earp.
By the turn of the century, he was already a celebrity of sorts. That's about when Wyatt Earp and his wife Josephine traveled to Nome at the height of the gold rush to start a saloon. Legend has it he briefly passed through the gold mining town of Juneau and left something valuable behind, a Smith & Wesson No. 3 revolver that to this day is a kitschy tourist attraction in a downtown bar. According to the legend, the revolver was confiscated by U.S. Marshals when Wyatt Earp was changing steamships in Juneau. Given the man's fearsome reputation as a gunfighter, federal marshals demanded, or so the story goes, that Wyatt Earp surrender his weapon while in town. His boat to Nome in the morning left earlier than the federal offices reopened, The gun went unclaimed in federal custody. You can take the story at face value, but I got to talking with Juneau newspaperman James Brooks.
How did Wyatt Earp's gun come to be on the wall of the Red Dog Saloon?
We agreed there's got to be more to the story. Eric Forst owns the modern-day Red Dog Saloon, where the pistol's been a fixture for decades.
So the story that I got was that back in the early 1900s, 19-teens or 20s, the gun was part of what was then this territorial museum.
Forst said the story is that a museum employee, or at least someone with access to its treasures, had a bit of a drinking habit.
And he periodically would pay off his bar tabs with stuff out of the territorial museum. And at one point, he had a significant bar tab at the Red Dog Saloon, and he paid that with that gun.
The Territorial Museum would later become the Alaska State Museum. Steve Henriksen, curator of collections, humored my question.
Well, I really can't rule anything out, but I have been through the records pretty thoroughly over the last 30 years, and I've never seen it listed either as something that belonged to the museum or as a loan.
I asked State Archivist Zachary Jones if there's any record of Wyatt Earp passing through Juneau.
We have records that document him in Nome, but documenting a short stop in Juneau on his way to Nome is a little more difficult.
The only written account of Wyatt Earp's time in Juneau comes secondhand. It's contained in the official history of the first 50 years of the Alaska State Troopers and references federal records discovered in the 1960s.
And those letters purportedly say that U.S. Marshals had a firm discussion with Wyatt Earp when he arrived in town. If that's true, it's really interesting. I still don't understand why a U.S. Marshal would want to accost and sort of run off a retired law officer.
Not only is it questionable the pistol belonged to Wyatt Earp, now there's doubt he was even ever here. It felt like a dead end, and I told James as much.
Did you look at the sailing schedule?
No, actually, I haven't gone that deep into it. I'm not sure if such records still exist from that time period.
You could find the steamship schedule.
Oh, yeah?
Those are out.
Okay, where do I find those?
I'd start with the State Museum.
I didn't find timetables, but there's a trove of old newspapers on microfilm in the state archives. I thumbed through Juneau's Daily Alaska Dispatch. I had a date and the name of the steamship. The sign on the wall said he'd been disarmed on June 27th, 1900. He supposedly sailed 2 days later on the SS Senator. Juneau's newspapers around that time are full of news about miners heading to Nome and ads for Rainier beer. But there's nothing about Wyatt Earp or that ship. But I was looking in the wrong place. There's an item in the Nome Daily News reporting on Wyatt Earp's arrest in a drunken brawl. It's dated June 29th, 1900, the day he supposedly left his gun in Juneau. So there's a hole in the story right there. But just because the dates are wrong doesn't mean the whole story's bunk. But it probably is. From the get-go, bar owner Eric Forst told me he bought the saloon, but not necessarily the legend around Wyatt Earp's pistol.
The reality is of how it got to the Red Dog Saloon may be lost to history. I don't know. I've never heard, you know, the story as I've been told is what I told you, but I've never seen any documentation of how it ended up from one place to the other.
So at this point, James, I'm actually pretty stumped.
Well, I mean, maybe that's for the best. I mean, this is someone whose life is shrouded in legend. There's almost as many tall tales as there are facts. And so maybe it's kind of appropriate that it's that way.
True or not, it remains a good yarn, which keeps people coming back to the Red Dog Saloon. For AK, I'm Jacob Resnick in Juneau.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Stephanie Sieber in McCarthy. Sieber is a massage therapist who moved to McCarthy in 2009 from Colorado.
It was, I guess, tragedy, actually, that got me here. You know, like the bottom falling out of life, and it just seemed like the right time to make a move. I did some rambling through the lower 48 for a while, mostly to the mountain states, Montana, Idaho. I spent a little time in Vermont. And I feel like it was just always kind of in the plan was to come to Alaska. It just felt like the direction my life was moving. I ended up driving up the Alcan in the very beginning of March, I believe, in a Jetta, fully loaded Jetta. So it was an adventure to get here. A couple snowstorms. I found myself in McCarthy, Alaska, which was this great little net and felt like a warm hug from my soul. My first winter was awesome. I actually got to stay in my neighbor's cabin because it was before I had built mine. And so it was still like living out of a duffel, which I had done for years. but it was great. It was cold. The Northern Lights that winter were off the charts. McCarthy in general has a pretty strong sense of camaraderie. And I think that in the wintertime, it's just exemplified even further. I may wish that all my water was hauled, but I actually have to go and do that. Haul the buckets, clean the buckets. You know, like there's steps here to living that aren't like other places. It was great to be able just to slow down and to read a book for an entire day, maybe, or, you know, go cut some trees down for an entire day without thought of, oh, I have this to do tomorrow. And, you know, again, this cumulative list of things to do doesn't really exist anymore in my mind, I guess. It's just doing.
Stephanie Sieber lives in McCarthy. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Jacob Resnick, Aaron McKinstry, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Dacia Eaton in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. You know your teenager is struggling, friends have changed, grades have dropped, and when you try to talk, they argue or ignore you. Don't wait until it gets worse. Take action by calling Alaska Crossings. Alaska Crossings has helped hundreds of teens gain back their confidence and self-esteem in a full, fun, outdoor environment. The program is now accepting applications for troubled teens ages 12 to 18. Visit alaskacrossings.org and apply today. Alaska Crossings. Youth succeed here. This message sponsored by Alaska Crossings. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.